Welcome to the XYZ Experiment podcast. Today we have myself, Dash, and Fiona, and we have a guest, Dr. Scarlett Howard. Welcome, Scarlett.
Thank you for having me.
So Scarlett is at Monash University with me and is a lecturer and a research group leader in the School of Biological Sciences. Her research spans cognition, behaviour, pollination, ecology, zoology, neurobiology, environmental change, and bio-inspired solutions, which is a lot. We're going to touch on some of it, but probably not all of it, but I encourage you to have a Google. And Scarlett also has a radio show called, remind us what your radio show is called.
It's called Einstein A Go-Go on 3RRR. I am not in charge of it. I'm a co-host.
Co-host. But Scarlett, how about you start by just telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, as you said, I'm a scientist working at Monash University at the moment. I have been doing bee research for, I think it's almost 12 years now, wow. Which is through my master's and PhD. And to do that, I've been able to travel all over the world, which is pretty cool. So I've lived in France, actually, to do bee research. And also been like to Germany and many places for conferences. I'm going to India next week to talk about bees. And so that's kind of my professional side. On the personal side, if I think of weird little facts about myself, I love reading high fantasy and I write a little bit, but nothing published, just for fun.
Yeah.
And I run a little bit too much. I don't know. Those are kind of boring things. But
you run a little bit too much. What does that mean?
This week so we're Saturday. I've run every day since Monday this week. And I'm probably also like at this age in my life, like in my 30s, I should be doing like lifting weights and taking care of my bones. But I'm just like, oh, no, I'll just go for a run.
You love running.
Yep.
It's probably been out in nature as well. Like it's everything, isn't it? You know, it really is. And do you run a lot along the river and things like that?
Wherever I can, I suppose. Like always keen to run along bodies of water. So go to the beach and have a run along the water there, or lakes, or, along the little river near my place as well.
When you're doing that, this is a little sidebar, are you looking for bees? Like, do you ever sort of look around and think, oh, I think there's going to be bee activity around here or anything like that? Just because you research it, do you look for it?
Not while I'm running, because world goes past. Not that fast, faster than. But when I'm walking, when I'm hiking, I'm constantly looking for, especially native bees, like honeybees, they're just everywhere. That's the European honeybee, which we'll probably talk about later. But the native bees are a little bit more hard to spot. And so when the season's coming, like now we're going from winter kind of into the springtime, and I've seen the flowers blooming that my bees go to, and I'm looking for them on those flowers. I haven't seen any yet. So when I'm on hikes and walks, I will stop everyone. I did it on the weekend. I was hiking in the Grampians and literally was stopping all the time to be like, oh, there's flowers here, let's just have a quick look.
Even
other insects, you know.
Now, we ask every guest on our podcast what generation you belong to and what's the most generational thing about you. And does that apply to you?
That's a really funny question. Yes, so I'm a millennial, and I've sort of already touched on it, but I think like just getting hard into running when I hit 30 was maybe the most millennial thing about me. I feel like I've had this conversation with like many of my colleagues and friends that there's sort of a few either crafty hobbies or sport hobbies that you get in once you hit 30.
Yeah.
And I think running's one of them. We were talking about climbing being another one.
Yes. Very much so.
I think also like Zumba used to be one of those things, but I don't know if it's as much anymore. But then it's like it might be like crocheting or knitting.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that was me. I went hard into running, and that might be the most millennial thing about me.
We've touched on this a little bit, but I guess, you know, we've talked about bees, but your research does focus on miniature brains, which we're going to talk about, and how they solve complex problems. And I guess before we get into your research, how did you become a researcher, and particularly in this area?
Well, surprisingly, just because I work on insects, I was not this kid that was running around collecting insects. I actually would say for most of my life before starting bee work, I was pretty scared of bees and pretty lackluster in interest on insects. I loved science and loved animals and thought that the only job for that was, oh, you've got to be a vet. So I think I went my whole schooling life thinking, oh, I guess I'll just be a vet, not really knowing what that meant. And I'm really glad I didn't. I don't think it would have been the right job for me. But yeah, got to university and sort of slowly over the years of undergraduate realised, oh, research is a thing, but you also don't have to do, I guess, really invasive research if you don't want to. You can do observing animal behaviour and just seeing what they do. And that's sort of where I fell in love with working with animal behaviour. And I was working with some lizards at the time. Ooh. And then I heard from this guy that I didn't know at the time. He would later go on to be my master's and PhD supervisor, friend and colleague now as well. He told me about the work he did where bees could recognize human faces, they could see visual illusions, and I just thought, that's absolute rubbish. You're not telling me the truth. Like, that can't be true. And so I guess I don't know. Someone said it to me the other day. I kind of spite went into bee research at first. Not really. Yeah. I just thought that sounds too incredible to be true and I didn't quite believe him. And then I saw what they could do in my master's degree working with bees and I was like, this is quite amazing. I wouldn't have thought these animals with such small brains could understand concepts and learn rules and then demonstrate that, apply that knowledge to new problems that we gave them.
That's incredible. Like, you can't see my face of amazement, but when you said that they recognise faces, wow.
Yes, you can train them to recognise human faces, which probably means that they might, beekeepers, their little bees might be recognising their faces too. Maybe also other things like their scent and that sort of thing, but definitely they can learn faces.
So with your research, is it specifically around bees and tiny brains, is that right, or...?
I would say most of my work revolves around bees. Okay. I sometimes do a few little other things. I might look at human behaviour, or I also dabble a little bit in art and culture sort of things now and then.
Yeah.
But overall, I work on bees, but quite broadly. So I try and integrate different things like conservation, ecology, but also like cognition, neurobiology, neuropharmacology at some points, and then like bioinspired tech as well. Mm. And just I use them as a model for so many things because I think they're quite amazing to work with. And they, yeah, the stuff that they can do can be applied to so many different areas.
Let's just take a step back and go to the fact that bees can recognize faces and you can teach them rules and you can teach them all sorts of cool things. How do you do that?
One of the most popular questions I get, yes. I think I mentioned to this before we started talking, it's a process, but a really fun process. We can train a single bee to do things depending on the complexity of the task within an hour or within a few hours. It has to be within, well, it doesn't have to be within a day, but mostly our experiments are just running through a day. We work with one, let's just stick to European honeybees at the moment because that's the species we work with the most in terms of cognition.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like bee intelligence, basically. Mm. So the European honeybee is a non-native animal in Australia. They live in these big hives. Not all bees live in these big hives, these eusocial hives where they work together. They have task sharing and there's one queen, then a bunch of non-reproductive female workers, and then there's also drones, which are the males that reproduce with the queen. And so these bees, the foragers that are coming in and out of the hive, these are the ones we're working with. They're going out and they're visiting flowers. And we kind of capitalize on that behavior and ask them to do different things. So what we initially do is we have a few hives that might be set up and we will set up a feeder, which is just, it's not very sophisticated. It's a jar full of sugar water.
Mm-hmm.
And we tip it upside down on this little plate that has grooves in it. And yep. So the sugar comes out. And then we might grab a bee from the front of the hive with a little spoon. This is like a little transparent plexiglass specialized bee spoon. If you saw it, you're like, oh, that's just a stick with a with a flat end. And you're right. So we pick them up from the front of the hive, these workers that are going in and out to forage, and we bring them over to the sugar feeder. And especially if there's not a lot of flowers around, so if we're talking summer when it's really hot and the flowers have kind of died off, this sugar feeder will be amazing for them. They'll be like, this is great. They'll go back to the hive and they'll do their little dance called a waggle dance. We can talk about this a bit later. This tiny dance they do just communicates to the other bees in the hive that there's a good food source nearby. And so then they'll be like, oh, those bees will recruit more and more and they'll keep dancing and then you'll get a bunch of bees coming to this feeder. So when they're comfortable coming to this feeder and collecting the sugar water, we go over there with an even greater concentration of sugar water. So we might have given them 10% or 5%. We go over there with like 50%. and put the spoon under their proboscis, so their little tongues,
yeah.
or on their antennae. We just touch it and they're like, whoa, this is amazing. So they climb onto our spoon and we take them over to what we call probably like an apparatus, very scientific term. But it might just be a screen that we can hang little hangers on, and they have little platforms we can present stimuli, little printed cards of shapes or patterns, that sort of thing. So we put the bee on the little hanger platform with some more sugar. She drinks that. She then goes to fly off to go back to her hive. She does what's called a little orientation flight, which is a few little circles above it just to be like, I want to remember this place.
Yeah.
Hopefully she comes back. She goes back to her hive, and then because our apparatus has a higher concentration of sugar, she wants to come back to that rather than feeder. Hopefully she will then continue to come back within a few minutes. And then because they're central place foragers, they can remember really well where we are, where the hive is, it's easy for them. But they'll also then continue to come back over and over again because they're working for the hive, not for themselves. So if you work with, like, I mean, a dog is probably a bad example, but like other animals will get full. You can give them lots and lots of treats, and then at a certain point, they're like, I'm not going to work anymore.
Yeah.
I'm full. Bees are working for the hive. So they're actually collecting the sugar water. They go back to their hive. They vomit it up, give it to their other hive mates to make into honey, and then they'll come back to us. So they're never full. And that's their whole day, is going to flowers, collecting nectar and pollen. So instead, they just switch over to coming to us to get sugar water, which is very similar to nectar. And so we have this little participant that's really keen to come back for hours and hours, like while the sun's up, basically. And it's warm enough, not raining. And there they are.
And they just go back and forth, back and forth, back and
exactly.
forth. And then bring their mates with them.
Yes, which sometimes gets annoying because we just like to work with one at a time. So we kind of have to manage that and be like, okay, don't give them too much so they think it's too good in dance. But also, yeah. So it works pretty well.
Yeah.
But sometimes we do get other bees like trying to participate in the experiments, and we just want that one. So we put a little dot of like colour mark on her. So
yes.
Like we know who she is.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So we use like that non-toxic queen paint.
Yeah.
And then we know which one is ours, and we go from there, and we can start to show them visual stimuli and ask them to learn how to use a maze or things like that, and then we can start experiments with them.
Will they remember that the next day? Is it a forever memory, or is it just that day that we've got them?
They will come back the next day. If they're still alive. I mean, they do have relatively short lifespans
yes.
outside of the hive because
yeah.
it's quite a dangerous and very tough environment. They're working so hard. But yeah, we all the time, the bees will come back for the next few days trying to re-participate in the experiment.
Yes.
But we've moved
okay.
on to the next bee to ask.
Okay.
And they do remember. They remember to come back to us. And there's also studies showing that their long-term memory can be pretty good as well. So they would probably also remember how to do the task for a few days at least, maybe weeks, maybe
That's
months.
That's incredible. How long does a female bee last for on average?
So in the summer, it's a bit shorter because they're working so hard, or it's the spring and the summer. So they'd be out of the hive maybe after 3 weeks. So they spend about 3 weeks in the hive. Then maybe, depending on a lot of factors, they might be out of the hive for 2 weeks, 4 weeks, could be 6 or 8 weeks, you know, so
it's
quite a range.
Yeah.
And then, they usually, as those foragers, they kind of work themselves to death or they get predated on.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Wow.
Okay.
And then the bees that are in the hive and don't forage, do they live longer?
They are doing different tasks, but they will eventually become foragers. So bees have this sort of, you start off, you come out of your cell, you're a newly emerged bee, then you clean your cell, that's your first task. Then you might go on to being a nurse bee, so you're looking after the other larvae and that sort of thing. There's a few different tasks in the hive. And then you might graduate and you do another task and another task. You know, then often they might become the guard bees that sit out just at the entrance of the hive and make sure no one gets in who shouldn't be in there.
Wow.
And those are probably the ones that usually sting you with no cause.
Mm. Yeah.
Because they're looking for danger. And then eventually they would become foragers, and that's their last sort of life stage. And they work for, you know, hopefully they're working for, you know, somewhere between 4 and 8 weeks outside of the hive and just going and collecting nectar and pollen and that sort of thing for the hive.
Why are bees so important? Why is this so important?
So bees, now we're talking about all bees. So European honeybee is just one species, but we have about 20,000 species globally.
Oh, wow.
And in Australia, we have named just over 1,600 species, but we probably have an estimated 2,000 to 3,000 species. So we've actually got about 10% of global That's species big. Richness in yeah. Australia. Yeah. But we just have 5% of land mass, I think it is. So we're doing pretty well for bee diversity. And there's a lot of reasons why they're so important. Obviously, we're thinking about plant-pollinator interactions, their pollination services. So not only are they pollinating food crops and contributing to food security for us, I think the average number we say is like one in every mouthful of food you have is probably by bees. And then the other side of that is if we think of our native bees, a lot of them are pollinating our native flora. Yeah. So that's really important too. And they are generally keystone species in the environment, which means that they're just vitally important. They're one little part of a massive ecosystem and they are holding up a whole lot of like the food web and, you know, all the sort of ecosystem processes that occur, like they're very central to it. So mm-hmm. yeah, the diversity of just Australian native flora is really dependent on them as well.
So at your workplace then, do you have hives that you work with? Like, are they in an outdoor environment? Are they in a, how controlled is the environment?
They live in our native reserve at Monash University. It's called the Jock Marshall Reserve.
Yeah.
Don't know if you
know. I don't know where that is.
So it's on the Clayton campus, actually. It's really nice. So it's a biodiverse native habitat and it's quite big. And so, I mean, unfortunately, maybe, we put our honeybees there, which are obviously not native. So we've got a couple hives. We put them really far away from everything else, though. And there's also one sort of what you would call like a feral colony or a wild colony there too, living in a tree. But yeah, they live in this big reserve where they can go and forage. And then one of my colleagues, actually Carmen De Silva, she went out and looked on campus at how many native species we have, and they got more than 80 native species as well. So our honeybees are there, but then we've also got a lot of native species just on campus.
You talked about the European honeybees, and then you've talked about the native honeybees or native bees. Can a non-scientist tell the difference between these two?
It's really easy when it comes to just that distinction. The honeybees are everywhere. They're our typical bee that you see out and you're like, that's a bee. They are the yellow and black striped ones. They're relatively, like, they're big, compared to a lot of the native species are quite small. Now, many of the native species, probably if you're not a bee expert or obsessed with bees, you're most likely going to get them mixed up with flies because a lot of them look black, especially when they're moving fast. They do actually, a lot of them have like little other markings, which are really cool. Some of them have these, they're black, but then they have these yellow face masks that are beautiful. One I really like that's not, it's not well loved. I think it's actually called a trash bee sometimes. So that's like Lasioglossum species. So I work on Lasioglossum linearum and it's got kind of cream and black stripes on it. Then there's also like the Amagilla bees, which are blue banded bees and they are obviously blue, blue and black striped. So they are beautiful. We have like three of those species in Melbourne.
How did the honeybees get introduced to Australia then?
On purpose.
Yeah.
Okay. For agriculture.
Okay. Yeah.
And the honey as well, I'd say.
And a long time ago, I take it.
200 years or so.
Yeah. So they've been here a long time.
They have. So I think people don't call them invasive species anymore. It depends who you talk to. Yeah. They're naturalized in a way.
Okay. And how come Australia's doing so well with bees compared to other countries in the world?
In terms of the species richness?
Yeah.
I would say because we're this massive continent island, a lot of our species have evolved in isolation.
Yeah.
And so I guess we have a lot more diversification. We're a really big country as well. And so we have, many of our bees are endemic, which means they're found nowhere else in the world and they're just in Australia. I think the majority of bees in Australia are endemic species, so you won't find them outside of Australia. So that's probably one of the reasons we do so well.
It's the isolation.
Mm. And we've got many climactic zones as well for them to live in. So if it's a bee that, you know, likes a more Mediterranean environment or a more temperate environment or, you know, a really arid environment, which some of them do, or there's desert bees as well that live in deserts and do amazing things too. So we've got all these different climactic areas in Australia too, which can support a really big diversity of bees.
And Australia's pretty good in trying to protect the bees from like infections and all that sort of stuff, aren't they? I can't take honey from here to WA or something like that, you know. And I know
can't
they.
You?
No, you're not allowed to take
They're
honey
really
between the states.
Honey. Yeah.
Between
now,
states.
And there was a big outbreak in Queensland recently, I know. Was it last year?
Over the last few years, Varroa mite has made it to Australia, which are those mites that are sort of linked with colony collapse in many other countries. Australia has not had it, and we were the last continent and probably getting towards one of the last countries, not the last country, but to have this mite, which causes like a lot of different viruses. So the viruses luckily haven't, the worst virus, deformed wing virus, which is again linked with colony collapse disorder, it doesn't seem to have made it with the varroa mite infection, but it's still not good for their health. And there was a lot done to try and prevent the spread and stop it and hopefully eradicate it, but it didn't work. And now, it has spread from New South Wales into both Queensland and Victoria. More options in the future to slow it more. People are working on it.
Okay. And that's part of the reason why you can't move colonies from state to state or take honey between the states. It's quite strict.
Goodness, I did not know that.
Yeah. So when we were talking about these complex problems that we're getting them to solve, why is that important? Why are we studying that? And what is that doing? Like, is it something to do with our own brains? Like, what does that represent?
So let's probably start with what a complex problem might be for a bee. So my work, as an example, I test numerical abilities of bees. A large part of my work does that, not everything. But I've tested like addition and subtraction, do they understand the concept of zero? Can they categorize odd and even numbers? Can tell you a bit more about those later if you're interested.
Wow.
But things like that. So I would consider a lot of that quite complex. And also maybe for most people, they would say that is really far from an ecologically relevant behavior. Now, there might be other complex behaviors we get them to do, like discriminating between colors that are really, really close, perceptually difficult task, we would call that. Or patterns that are, very close together and see how well they can learn things like that and apply knowledge. So there's complex tasks that could be ecologically relevant or ecologically irrelevant. And I work on both of those sorts of things. Now, the reason that testing these complex tasks are important is for a range of reasons. So number one would be, if we're talking about all sorts of bees as well, conservation, just understanding their behavior better, how they interact with plants, because if you're showing them colors or patterns or shapes and trying to work out, how do you learn this? How do you remember this? Are you impacted by temperature when you look at this? Or, if you've come from a really urbanized area versus a really rural area, does that change your ability to do these tasks? Like for navigation purposes, for discriminating between flowers that have different shapes, sizes, colors, scents, that sort of thing. So it tells us a lot about that. Also, the evolution of intelligence for me is quite an interesting question. How different are we from bees, from octopuses, from ants, all that sort of, those sort of questions I'm really interested in. And then there's also things like applying these questions to bio-inspired technology. So if a tiny bee brain that has less than a million neurons can do a similar task to us with our sort of 100 billion neurons, there's got to be something really efficient that they're doing. And especially when we give that same task to a computer and we are using so much energy with a computer. So bio-inspired technology is technology inspired by biological systems such as animal brains or even, neuromorphic technology is another, it's a related area. And you might build technology that's based on, the movements of animals or the behavior of animals or, their morphology, what they look like, basically. Or even there's a lot of stuff that goes on with bio-inspired materials.
Yeah,
and that
right.
could be like butterfly wings and things like that. So, there's a lot of different ways studying the intelligence of bees can be beneficial.
Because the one thing that's going through my head as well is as we urbanise our countries, and we grow and we can see a lot of these new suburbs that have been built aren't thinking about the trees and the plants. Like people don't have gardens like they used to. Does that also mean that you could have an impact in environmental design for these sorts of urbanisations to say this is what we need to support our little creatures, this is what we need?
Yeah, some of our recent work is actually on urbanisation impacts on bees, native bees in particular, and we're really interested in those questions. And it's actually part of I have an Australian Research Council DECRA, which is an award for early career researchers for about 3 years. And so that's the topic of my fellowship there. And we're having a look at how things like, so what happens when we have really urbanised areas that these things will affect bees are things like increased proportion of impervious surfaces. So that's like concrete, you know, that can't be permeated. And 60% of native bees or more in Australia are ground nesting. So they actually burrow into the ground, and they can't do that if you've got mulch there or if you've got a road and lots of concrete and brick and that sort of thing. There's also more invasive or non-native, I should say, flora in those environments too. And some of our native bees are specialised on particular native plants. So if we've got more introduced plants, that's not good for some of those bees. It actually works for some of the other native bees that are generalists and they'll just go to anything. Some of them actually love weeds. I catch a lot of my bees looking at them, observing them on weeds, and they love them. But those are generalists that will go to a lot of different flowers. Then there's things like, you know, introduced species like the honeybee. We don't have a lot of information on whether the honeybee competes directly with native bees and if that causes an issue for them. People are trying to work on it, but it's a very complex topic and basically we don't know. But yeah, with urbanisation comes all these things. Also increased pesticide use, which really impacts bees, the neonicotinoids, cause cognitive decline as well as mortality and all these sorts of horrible things for lots of our beneficial insects, not just pollinators like bees and flies and wasps and beetles and that sort of thing, but also like beneficial invertebrates that might be in the soils, like your worms and, all sorts of animals.
You guys are too young to remember when you used to stand on your street and the vans would go past just spraying insecticides everywhere, you know, for mosquitoes and all that sort of stuff. You just wonder, what were they killing off? Like, wow.
Yeah, I have worked on farms, though, where they have started spraying pesticides on us, not realising we're trying to help them with their food security problems. And then they've just come through spraying and we've got like cameras out watching what the bees are doing on the flowers, how they're interacting with their crop flowers and that sort of thing. And we had to like get out of there. But I think maybe some of the cameras got sprayed. We got a little bit sprayed, but not too much.
Wow.
I mean, when it comes to pesticides, probably a little bit is too much. But yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to see how Australia uses pesticides as well. But that's not a topic I do much work on. I don't know a whole lot about it. But Australia does use quite a bit of pesticides in our agriculture and just like in our daily lives.
Along with urbanisation, and I know when I look at my weather app and I put in different areas, even in Victoria, you can see quite a difference in temperature. So because I also live close to the city, we seem to, particularly in summer, be a little bit hotter versus then if I'm near the beach or in other areas. And I'm just wondering, at what point do bees go, this is too hot for me and I'm not going to be able to cope with this temperature?
It's a good question, and I think it varies per species, which makes that question very complex and hard to solve. So climate change, increasing temperatures, is obviously a really big issue for lots of animals. Pollinators are being impacted by increased temperatures as well. And we're seeing, you'd probably say mostly negative effects. There's some beneficial things, actually. There's one native bee species that someone did some modelling on, and it's quite widespread. And it will actually, this is in Australia, it will actually increase its range under climate change. So I would say there's good and bad. It's probably mostly not so great in terms of what impacts climate change will have on bees and other pollinators, particularly like increased fires and floods too. That's really damaging for ground nesting bees, the flooding as an example, but also the fires are quite obviously bad for like cavity nesting bees that nest in like fern fronds in the Dandenongs as an example, or other sort of woody areas. And there's there was an example of that on Kangaroo Island when the bushfires went through. Mm-hmm. There was these beautiful green and blue metallic bees there, and I think they're a Xylocopa species, and they were undergoing a like threatened species program where they'd built all these nests for them, and researchers had really risen the population of them, and then the bushfires came through and wiped out all their work. And that was like, that happened in the few years ago now, but there's one example of like increased fires and increased flooding will also impact bees, which is maybe not something you associate. The high temperatures are also a problem for them too. And being in urban environments, then you've got all these interacting threats, which is one of the most understudied things, but probably one of the biggest problems is what you call that death by a thousand cuts concept, which is So you've got these pollinators, and we might look at, as researchers, temperature in isolation or urbanisation impacts in isolation or pesticide use in isolation, but really what's happening to a bee that's trying to live in the city. And we know they're in Melbourne, like in these tiny little green spaces and stuff. We've got ground nesting bees. I know because I see them and I go out and look at them. And yeah, they've got to contend with, disturbance of roads and that sort of thing, you know, impervious surfaces, as we talked about, the more pollution, more pesticides, insecticides as well, and things like chemical runoff into the ground too that might go into their nests.
Oh, yes.
Then you've got the urban heat island effect. So as
yes,
you said, it being
it's
more
very
hot in cities. And then again, as we said, like possibly more competition, possibly more predation, like spiders and that sort of thing being more concentrated in cities, I'm not sure. But yeah, an invasive flora and that sort of thing. So you have like probably dozens of things that are attacking them at once. And so studying those interacting impacts is becoming increasingly important rather than just studying one thing in isolation, because it's not the full story of what's happening to them in the real environment.
Because I'm just thinking, I don't see bees that much around my apartment, but when I go into the botanical gardens, they're everywhere. And actually one did sting Pete Uncle, my dog. And luckily I had read about how to remove a bee sting.
Poor little dog.
I know. And she was so dramatic about it. Had to get carried home and then we had to ice it, and she played it up for a while. But luckily she wasn't allergic to being stung by a bee and she recovered totally fine. Yeah, around our area, and when I take her for walks generally, we do not see any bees. Well, I'm only looking for the black and yellow.
You're looking for honeybees, aren't you? You've got to look for the little black ones that look like flies.
I know. So actually this has been really interesting information, because there's obviously a lot that I'd probably be missing. What have you learnt about bees that tell us about our brains?
Ooh, that's a really good question. Many things, I suppose. So I'll talk about one of the ones that is one of the most interesting pieces of work I've done. So somehow our little team came up with the idea that we would test whether bees could categorize quantities as odd or even.
Yeah.
And to this day, I'm not really sure why I came up with that, because often I get my inspiration by looking at cognition and intelligence experiments that have been done with like fish or birds or, you know, big primates. And what I found was that no one had ever tested any other animal except for humans on the ability to do this. And I don't think I even knew that before I started the experiment. This is during my PhD. And so I created these stimuli. So if you go back to the apparatuses I was talking about, we tested them on this big circular screen that stands upright, and then it has little pegs on it that we hang those hangers on. And on these sort of hangers, where there's a little landing platform for bees underneath, we can put a picture, and it's like a printed card with laminae on it. And that might be three triangles, four squares. Yeah, get the picture. Yeah. And what we do is we show two correct options and two incorrect options. And so let's say I'm training a bee, this particular bee today, I want her to go to the even numbers and avoid the odd numbers. So I train the bees on the numbers 1 to 10. And every time she came back, so she'd make a landing choice and say, on one trial, that might be 3 versus 4. And if I'm training her to even, that means if she lands on 4, she gets a little reward of sugar water. And if she lands on 3, she tastes something bitter. It's kind of like tonic water. And it's called quinine. And it's not enough to make them stop coming, but they really dislike it. And they were like, if they do get any in it, they'll like spit it out. But and touching it is enough for them to be like, oh, that's awful. So they want to avoid that. And that really improves their discrimination ability. Sometimes if you just use like sugar water and water, or sugar water and nothing, they're like, oh, well, it's not that bad. I just lose a little bit of time. But when you and they can do simple and some actually complex tasks just in that training. But if you introduce this tonic water, they're like, okay, I'm going to avoid that. I don't want that. And so, yeah, over time, every time this bee comes back, I'm gonna switch the positions of the stimuli. I'm going to show them a different number. Next time they come, it might be, 7 versus 2 or 10 versus 9 and so on over many trials. I think our average number was somewhere between about 45 to 50 for them to learn the task. Usually I set a certain number of trials they have to complete, but here I just trained till they reached 80% correct over 10 trials. And yeah, so I did that for a while and tested a lot of bees. And then what we did was give them a learning test where we present them with a novel shape they've never seen and a pattern they've never seen before as well. So we've chosen two numbers within that training set to show them that they've never seen before. So at the start of the experiment, we show them 1 to 10, but we might take out, you know, 3 and 6 or something.
Yeah.
Or another bee might, you know, be 7 and 4.
Yeah.
Something like that. Anyway, so then in a learning test, we show them these numbers they've never seen before using a shape they've never seen before. So maybe a diamond or something. And we just put water on all of the hangers and we see which ones they try to land on the most. And then what we did after that was give them what we call a transfer test. So transfer your knowledge. That's like a transfer within the range of what they've seen before. And then we gave them 11 versus 12. Now, an animal should really not be able to, well, I don't know, because they did it. 11 versus 12 should be extremely difficult for them.
Yeah.
And so we did the same thing. We put water on there so there's no reinforcement for choosing correctly or incorrectly. They've never seen the shape before or the number. And then we saw what they wanted to land on and what they selected. And so over the course of the training, we saw that they learned significantly. So they started about 50%, which means they're making random choices and just trying to work out what is going on. I want to get the sugar, but there's also some weird pitches and, you know, they've got no idea what's going on. And then over the course of, you know, somewhere between, you know, 40 and 70 trials of coming back to this apparatus, they are increasing their learning. So they're increasing to about like 80% correct, which is pretty good for a bee trying to do odd and even numbers. And yeah, then we give them these tests and they did really well in the tests. They were performing well. They did it with the numbers within the range they've been tested on. And then they did it with the numbers that were higher that they never seen before and that were so close together, like 11 versus 12. And we've got videos of this as well. It's really impressive the way they come and they look at the pictures. They sort of buzz around them and have a look and then they might fly over to the other one and compare before they make a decision of when
Stop
to land.
It.
Yeah, so they don't just come in and like land. They like, once they, at the start, that's what they'll do and that's why they're getting like just random chance level of correct and incorrect. But then later on, they're like, okay, I've got to think, like I'm going to look at this one. Now I'm going to fly over to the other one, have a look at that one. And because we've got 2 correct and 2 incorrect, they can't just land on one of them, be like, oh, that's quinine. That's that bitter tasting one here. I'm just going to go straight to the other one. They still have to think because there's still another negative one. And sometimes if they really think that something's right, they don't care that, they do care there's quinine there, but they'll still keep like tapping it and being like, no, I really think this is right. And yeah, so that is what they do. That's how we train them. And I sort of got a little bit off track there, but coming back to your question, which is what does this tell us about our own brains? It was, I would have thought in the past that odd and even categorization was quite a human concept, construct of mathematics, basically, and a way for us to categorize number, which it seems like it is. And it seems also like it would be a really complex task for humans. Like we can use little tricks now. We know, if a number ends in 0, 2, 4, 6, 8, that's even. And if it doesn't, that's odd. Or we can, see, we could use division to also work it out. We can do that when the number, if we're using mathematics and if the numbers are symbolic. But these bees showing us that they could learn those concepts when they, maybe there's a reason they could use it in their everyday life. It sort of told me that either odd and even categorization wasn't as complex a concept as we thought, or their brains are doing something extremely efficient and not using that much energy, but also learning that with these tiny little brains. And so I would like to see if other animals can learn odd and even as well. That would be the next step to know, is this something really strange that just bees can do because they're really good learners, or are we seeing other animals also able to do it?
Wow.
And so I think that's something that taught me a bit about human brains too, because we did take it one step further and look at an artificial neural network with the most minimal amount of neurons we can make it. So it had 5 neurons, and we also had it do a task of odd versus even categorization, and it did really well as well. So it was able to do that just with 4 neurons. And so that has 4 neurons. Our bees have less than 1 million, and then human brains have over 100 billion. And 100, sorry, that was the wrong number. Just under 100 billion, I think. And all three, I don't want to call them species, all three of those artificial biological brains were able to do the same task, and that's quite impressive. But I think it tells us a lot about what the task is and what it means to be human a little bit, and how concepts are like learnt and applied.
Do you have like a lot of empathy for bees? As in, like, I don't want to eat their honey. I don't want to take their beeswax. These guys work so hard for that. I don't want to take that from them at all.
And they're really smart.
Yeah, I mean, I don't work a lot on the beekeeping side of things, so I suppose I'm not actively harvesting honey myself or anything like that.
But I don't mean like you harvesting it.
But would you eat honey?
Would it affect the way you think about eating honey or seeing a beeswax candle thinking, God, those guys.
I hadn't even thought about beeswax.
These girls
candle.
Work so hard to create this. Here we are just consuming it. Does that ever cross your mind?
I mean, I suppose it does make me I do have a lot of empathy for the bees, I suppose.
You would.
Like, so we try and do what we call these free flying experiments that are voluntary participation.
Yeah.
Like when you're asking a human, like, I'm like, you can come and you can get the sugar,
or
you could just leave at any time if you want to. Like, I can't stop
you. We're not forcing you.
And so I suppose that's probably more the way I think about it, is I try and keep my, what I do with them, like sort of this voluntary participation and, allowing them that way. I haven't given a whole lot of thought to the honey side of things, just I think because I'm not involved, I don't.
Yeah, it doesn't cross your mind that way.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wonder if, you know, you come the next day and then you bee with your marker and it's dead and you go, oh, damn.
That is sad. I do like the bees. I mean, as researchers, we're meant to be very objective.
Yeah, of course, of
but
course.
But I think people would claim to be objective in their research, but we love our work so much. I don't know if you can. I don't know. I'm sure it'll be the same with people who work on, like, dogs or wolves or lions. Like, you can create a certain level of objectivity, but I'm spending like 8 hours with this single bee. I've learned about her. She's got an interesting personality. I know that it's her flying in because she does some weird flight maneuver on her way. Whereas the bee I do the next day comes in, like, I sometimes have these bees that are so delicate and sensitive, and like they try really, really hard. And then I have these other ones that will come in just like, super
like a
quick, just like, yeah, exactly, like, yeah, sugar. And like it's quite interesting how different they are. So
is the smartness of your bees affected by the queen? Like, do different queens have different levels of smartness in their hives?
Now, I feel like this is a question I should know. In a lot of the work I've done and that I have seen, like, read, sometimes people have taken into account what hive the bees came from.
Mm.
And also, like, when we do work, because we might do summer work in Australia and then we go over to Europe and do the Northern Hemisphere summer there and have those two seasons, and we take that into account in analyses of, like, but people go one step further as well, and we have sometimes as well, and taken into account the actual hives.
Mm.
And generally it looks quite consistent.
Okay, yeah.
I think there are some cases where there's differences, based on the queen.
Like, temperaments too.
An older queen apparently has a little bit less control over the hive with her pheromones as she gets older, whereas younger queens have a little bit more control. And so you will get hives with younger queens are probably a bit more gentle and less aggressive.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's why I think these feral wild colonies that they call them feral colonies, I quite like them. But they can be more aggressive because no one's managing them actively. There's no beekeeper saying, oh, the queen's getting a bit old, maybe we should raise a new queen or something like that. So, it definitely affects their behaviour, their aggression, and probably quite a few other things as well. Intelligence-wise, I'm not sure, but there's a lot of individual variability, and there is probably some level of variability between hives.
I ask that because my sister has hives in her backyard. She has a beekeeper that comes around and just makes sure everything's okay quite regularly. And they're very calm bees. And I was talking to him once and he goes, oh, these are good queens. These are really good queens, these bees. And he's like, oh, okay, there's differences in queens. Okay.
Yes. We've covered a lot of ground, but I'm wondering if you face a lot of misconceptions about your research or the value of what you're doing or what it is you're doing.
Absolutely. I think people mostly now enter the conversation with curiosity rather than judgment. I would, like, this is talking about non-scientists here. I do a lot of science communication, but even just communicating with people I meet every day. If I say I work on bees, they are fascinated and they're like, we need to do something about the bees dying. And I'm like, I agree. Pollinator decline. And then I can get on my little soapbox and talk about, you know, the native bees. Like, because everyone's like, the honeybees. And I'm like, yeah. Also, did you know? And also, look at these blue bees. They're pretty cool. Which it's quite good. But I also think that because people understand the value of bees these days, I think they've had a real PR increase. Yeah. So that's it. Good PR lately. That people are really aware of that. So they're already coming in with a positive attitude with the work. And then it depends on who I'm talking to as well as what I lead with. So if they might be a little offside maybe with studying the intelligence of miniature insect brains, I probably will start with pollination and food security work that I do.
Yeah.
And then ease them in. Oh, and I also do intelligence. Whereas if I, you know, maybe I'm at a fun party, I don't know, and there's some interesting people there, maybe then I'm like, well, for a living, I look at whether bees can do mathematics. And they're like, what? And sometimes people don't know how to respond to that. I have talked to someone before who just, they stood there for a moment and then they changed the subject. And that was probably, seriously? And that's how you sort of learn about who you start, like where you start with your conversation. Like, oh, I work on pollination.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so important for me to get my food. Like, and they get that. But yeah, you kind of pick and choose how you discuss it. But I think people do get it. The things on mathematics and numerical abilities and cognition, that's probably more of a sell, and that's where I start talking about bi-inspired technology or even like, you know, evolutions of intelligence, or even just, as we said before, increasing their PR in people's minds. Oh, a bee can do addition and subtraction. They're smarter than I thought. Ooh, maybe I should, yeah, maybe it's quite important that unfortunately, the closer animals are to us, the more we care about them and the more conservation sort of money and social pressure gets put on saving those animals. Mm. So even for insects, like giving them a little bit of, yeah, they're a bit like us, can enhance that.
That's so interesting. Yeah, they can do odd and even identification, categorization. Let's keep them alive. Like, that's just... such an interesting PR exercise.
It's a good way to get towards, like, yeah, to work on conservation. Yeah. I suppose it's like, okay, we might bypass cute, fluffy. They are cute and fluffy, though. I will add that, though. But, you know, if you're looking at, like, a koala or kangaroo, you know,
yes.
Some animals have a one-up on the insects, but they do have cute and fluffiness. It's just at a smaller scale. But then we can go with, well, they're really smart and they have small brains and they're important for our food production, and people get that.
We talk a lot on this podcast because we have interviewed a few scientists about research funding and how that can potentially impact the work that we want to be doing and kind of the dreams for where we want to go. And your team sounds very passionate about the work that you're doing. If you had unlimited resources, what research would you be doing?
Again, that's a really interesting question, and I would say I would still be doing the things I'm doing. Our work often doesn't cost that much. Once we've got the general setup of these, we build these apparatuses, maybe a few more cameras to watch what the bees are doing, you know, a bit more traveling between, you know, the northern and southern hemisphere to get the two seasons and look at more native bees across the globe. But honestly, the work I'm doing, I just love it. Like, we can bees do mathematics on quite a tight budget? I probably shouldn't say this. Like, no one's going to fund me after this. And what we do is we go out and look at the native bees in nature and we can just watch them and see what they're doing, what are they visiting, and build pollination networks from there and work out, you know, in this environment, this species visiting this flower and this flower, and what does that mean and how many... you know, how strong is that connection between those two species? Again, I think if I had unlimited budget, I would probably still be doing a lot of what I'm doing now. Maybe enhance the bio-inspired aspect.
I was just going to ask, because that would be the more expensive
part.
That
would probably be the more expensive part. We've done a little bit in this area, but not a huge amount. And so probably, yeah, maybe I'm very naive on what I need to get bio-inspired tech going, but yeah, I reckon I'd need more money for that then. Let's say that. I think as well paying people. So, you know, there's if I had unlimited funds, I'd probably spend a lot of money just hiring more people and giving more jobs in academia for really passionate people. There's so many passionate people and less jobs.
That's a really good answer.
So we've spoken, I kind of went all over the place.
No, but I was like just thinking because there's so much conversation about like how much AI is like impacting on climate and all of that kind of stuff and just thinking about learning from bees and being efficient, and that is just incredible. Well, I was going to ask because you started and said you were afraid of bees and you're now not afraid of bees, and a lot of people are afraid of bees, including myself. So what advice would you give to people afraid of bees?
Start a master's on bees. So, yes, I can explain that a little bit. I was definitely that person. If you're in high school, you would remember this. Like, it's burned into my memory. If a bee came near me and I was eating lunch, you know, because I came come to check things out, I'd be that person getting up and sprinting away. Like,
same.
Like that.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So I was you. Okay. I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't know what – I think I went out onto this balcony. This is where my bees were in master's. This, you know, eccentric scientist, Adrian Dyer, who I still work with. I think he'd like to be called eccentric, actually. But he went, we collected a bee, as I told you before, with a bee spoon, and we brought it over to our box that we'd made from Bunnings. And he put her down, she drank her sugar water, and then she flew back. And I was like, all right, now we see what... If he was telling the truth, basically. And then she came back, and then she came back, and she came back again and again and dozens of times. And I was like, I was gobsmacked, I guess. I did not really think that would happen. And not that, I guess for a bee scientist, that is really just bland. That's the basics. And then you start to show them pictures, and they do things with the pictures, and they look at them, and then they try and make decisions, and they try not to do the wrong thing. And like, I was just like, they're not evil, not in that way, but they're not that scary. And like these single foragers we're working with, they're not trying to sting us. They don't care. Like, we're just there as a sugar dispensing outlet, really. And the other thing that I learned was actually honeybees are not very aggressive in general. Mm. Anytime, like quite often when people are stung, it's just by accident, like you've stepped on a bee and they've stung you, or you put your hand on something. Like, it's more rare that a bee just comes out of nowhere and stings you in the face. It has happened to me. Those guard bees are more aggressive. But in general, they are just quite gentle creatures. And I think spending so much time with sometimes up to 90 hives in some of the places I've been in Europe, and you're just like not getting stung. Like, they're not there to sting you. I think realizing that. So my advice would not be to go and hang out with 90 beehives if you're afraid of them. But I think just maybe trying to understand that they're actually very gentle creatures is maybe a start, and they're not actively trying to sting you. I think that's what, if you've been stung before, it's really scary and it does hurt a bit, but so I can understand where that comes from, especially if you're allergic too, that would be terrifying. But I had the same experience with wasps as well, I will say. So I've worked a bit on the European wasp now. And one of the ways I started doing that was that when I was running my experiments with bees, particularly this happened in Germany, the German wasp there kept trying to join in the experiments, like a few of them. And so I was doing this, what I was testing was an illusion of numerosity called the solitaire illusion. And it just makes you, if you look at it, it makes you think there's either more or less circles depending on like the patterns that are used. And so I just wanted to see, can bees see this illusion? And the wasps started self-recruiting and trying to land. And so I thought, all right, I'll just test these wasps because they keep trying to join in. And so I ended up making it a comparative study. So I had two animals, tested the bees, tested the wasps. And I just was astonished with how gentle wasps were as well.
Oh,
wow. Because they have an even worse reputation than bees for stinging.
They do.
And I have never, when working with wasps, never ever been stung.
Really?
And it was also really cute. I was so used to bees, and bees come in, and I think of them as quite motivated and quite focused when they're doing their tasks. And they kind of like, they do fly in and they do all the things we ask them to do. The wasps were another level. They flew in with a motivation and a kind of tunnel vision for the task that I had never seen before. And that was really cool. They're like very hard studiers. They wanted to get it right, and they actually seemed anecdotally and from watching them to get more upset when they tasted that quinine. Like they were so disappointed in themselves that they'd gotten it wrong. And so that it was actually quite an interesting study to do. And it turned out, just in case you're interested, that both wasps and bees do see the solitaire illusion like humans. So they mess up. Even if numbers are exactly the same, you show them, you know, like 10 versus 10, but one is organized in a different pattern. Yep, they mess it up. Mess it up just like humans.
That is fascinating, and I think hopefully it's given me a better appreciation for bees, and hopefully it'll give our listeners a better appreciation for bees and we won't run away screaming. Hi everyone, it's Dash. Thanks for taking the time to listen to the XYZ Experiment podcast, and don't forget to leave a rating and a review. If you've enjoyed our show and like what you're hearing, tell all your friends and family and hit that subscribe button. If you want to hear our updates and know when episodes drop, follow us on Instagram at the XYZ Experiment for all the latest updates and news. And our original music was composed and performed by the amazing Luke Champion.